This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm your host, Norman B. Coming up, we're going to talk about dogs and cats, but two very different issues on our favorite pets. Later in the show, a conversation about cats with Thomas McNamee, author of The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. With a naturalist's eye combined with humor and a warm heart, Thomas brings the always wild yet domesticated cat into delightful and insightful focus. Plus, I'll share a true story about the antics of Billy, my cross-eyed Siamese cat, who liked to steal my underwear. Perhaps Mr. McNee will be able to explain Billy's behavior. First, a new book boldly confronts two of the biggest challenges of our time, poverty and homelessness. In asking the question, who deserves the love of a pet? The title, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets, unites the causes of animal welfare and social justice. Accomplished writer Carol Mithers is the author. This is an important book, so please do listen carefully. Carol Mithers, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so let's get into this book of yours. Now, the history, from what I understand from reading your book, the history of the animal welfare movement began, what, around about the 1990s?
This is the current version of the animal movement.
So yes.
What we call colloquially the no-kill movement.
The no-kill movement.
Started late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, when people started talking about why are we killing so many dogs in shelters, dogs and cats. And the San Francisco ASPCA hired, which is the local version of the ASPCA, hired Richard Avanzino to run the department. And he basically said, why are we doing this? This is not necessary. We can start finding a way to not kill so many dogs and cats. And he promoted adoption and a beautiful new shelter. He got a lot of money from Maddie's Fund, which is software money, and basically remade the local shelter.
Yes.
And that movement caught on. And as it trickled down into the wider nation, other people started doing that, other shelters and other activists started saying, there is a way now that we cannot put down so many animals, we need to get them homes instead.
Yes, and this, the interest in this from your end came about how and why did you start to get interested in this? And then we'll get into Laurie Wise, the dog lady, in just a moment. But what was the impetus for you, Carol?
Well, it was kind of bizarre in that I read a Los Angeles Times story about a case of an animal hoarder. And I had never heard of such a thing. And it was kind of horrifying and yet captivating in a horrifying kind of way. And I thought I want to write about this. I have never read about this before. And I asked a friend who was a rescuer and said, do you know anything about this? And she said, you got to meet Laurie Wise, because Laurie had just come off dealing with such a person. So I went downtown and I met her and we talked about animal hoarding. And then I heard more about what she was doing. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I'd never thought about people in poverty and how that tied in with pet ownership. I mean, I had at that point, I didn't even have a rescue dog at that point. We got our first rescue dog in 99. And I knew nothing about this. I mean, my family got a dog from, as a child, I got my family dog because some people I babysat for had a dog that got out and impregnated a local female.
Yeah,
and we got one of the puppies, which
been
was
in there, had that. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
That was normal in those days.
Yeah.
So it started with that meeting with Laurie. It took a long time to figure out how it all fit together.
The dog lady. So let's talk about Laurie, because Just from reading your book, I get the feeling that this is a very special person.
Yes.
Can you tell my listeners just your take when you first met Laurie, just what your first reaction to her was?
Well, she doesn't seem like the kind of person who would tell the kind of stories she tells. She's very tall, very thin, very fair, and very quiet. And she does not self-promote. She simply is very matter of fact. And so to meet someone like this, who I know, my feeling was she looked like somebody who could have been a pioneer woman. She has that sort of wide cheekbones and sort of a faraway look in her eye. She's very, her posture is very impeccable, and but she has a very quiet energy to her. And so then to sit with someone like this and suddenly hear about stories about going into pretty violent and drug-ridden homeless encampments, and this was in the 90s, and working on Skid Row, you're just thinking, wait, what?
Yes. When you say Skid Row, and I think most people that are listening have some idea about what Skid Row means in their own city, wherever they live. And it seems to me now in any major metropolis, even smaller towns have some form of homeless problem. And Skid Row, of course, as we know of in Los Angeles, it's a huge part, particularly downtown. You live in Los Angeles, so I wonder if you could perhaps explain to my listeners that don't live in Los Angeles, that may have not been to Los Angeles, just give us just a small overview of what the homeless situation is like in Skid Row.
Well, it's everywhere at this point, but
Yeah.
in Skid Row historically was a place that attracted an itinerant population because it was at the very end of the rail line. So even
Yes.
100 years ago, when men, usually men, got off the train and didn't know what they were going to do in Los Angeles, they called them hobos back then.
Yes.
They ended up in cheap rooming houses in Skid Row. And eventually, it's about 50 square blocks in the heart of our downtown, which until fairly recently was not a thriving part of Los Angeles because the city developed and moved to the west. And so the money and the attention ended up west of downtown. And there were a lot of cheap rooming houses. It was where a lot of men, again, with alcohol issues, ended up because it was cheap to live there. A lot of social services sprang up there, the Midnight Mission, and places like that, where a man who was living in one of these single room occupancy hotels could get a meal, listen to some gospel preaching. And then in the 80s, LA went through a major bout of deindustrialization where we lost a lot of heavy industry, steel and auto plants and aerospace, and a lot of good jobs. I think it was a million jobs, union jobs, disappeared, and it really decimated the black middle class. And at that time, downtown started to get redeveloped, and a lot of the single room occupancy hotels disappeared. At the same time, crack moved in and became a problem. And this generation of white alcoholics they weren't the main force anymore. Then you had a lot of displaced people who are crack addicts, who are black, in the 80s, then also Latino, because there was a huge migration from Central America, people who did not have any resources. And it was a much harsher population, a much harsher place, which it remains. And the city made a conscious decision, in a sense, to keep that area what it was because they didn't want this population infiltrating the rest of the city.
So there's three, I guess, three issues here: poverty, drug addiction, and mental illness all come into
Yes.
play. And really, your book, in some respects, and I'm actually, I think it's about those three topics and the welfare of the dogs that are owned or belong to the people in these conditions. And they intertwine, the stories intertwine. There's such a lot of sadness in the book, but there's also a lot of hope. There's also a lot of wonderful highlights, but it's almost Dickensian when you really start to think about it. And I'm wondering, Carol, as you were thinking about putting the book together, before you even maybe put pen to paper, as they say, did it strike you that it was this sort of, it was almost like going back in time in some respects, in the just the tragedy of the situation?
In some ways, I mean, that is what we're seeing in a sense in the city as we struggle with housing and poverty, is that especially the image of Los Angeles is always such a sun-drenched, happy yes. place. And there's so much that is missed on that. I mean, some of the statistics I read shocked me when I realized that the majority of people who live here are renters. Huge numbers of people who can barely make rent. And you have these, because it's such a sprawling place, there's huge pockets of the city that other pockets never visit. And this is hidden. We yes. don't know about it. We don't yes. see it. We don't have to see it. In a central city, you go by, you run into people, and here you can avoid this.
Yes. Let's talk about the downtown dog rescue, which you talk about quite a lot in your book. I have to say, I'm sure I'm not alone in this. I don't know that I thought too much about what happens to those animals. How did that come to be that this person is on the street and they're taking care? I think they're taking care of an animal. But your book, Rethinking Rescue, really shines a light on these questions.
I should say, not all of them do a great job taking care of their
yes.
animals. There are
yeah.
people whose addictions and illness really prevent them from doing that. And I would also say that Lori and Downtown Dog Rescue did not help those people. There were people she met that she thought, this dog really isn't being cared for. This dog is being abused. It was like she had her own credo, which was, you know, if you hit your dog, if you tie your dog up, if you leave it, I'm taking it. It's mine.
Yes.
So we're talking more about people who meant to do well, who genuinely loved their animals, but maybe needed help. Those were people who could not properly take care of themselves. And so perhaps if you made it easy for them, certainly to get their dogs sterilized so that
yes.
you did not have a person caring for a dog with 9 puppies, get them certain kinds of veterinary attention. If a dog has mange, it suffers. It's fixable. If you don't have money or a car to take it to the vet, or the togetherness and thought processes to do that, it can be done for you. Food, vaccinations. And so her focus was people who love their animals, but who needed help being better owners. And in some cases, it was even just telling people, I know you don't want to take your dog's manhood, but let me tell you why that's a good idea, whether it's testicular cancer, or do you realize that this dog could result in 9 puppies, and the puppies will end up in the shelter and they will not find homes. So it was education and compassion and understanding. And there, just as in later when she dealt with people who were not unhoused but merely poor, it was hooking them up with their own services and seeing people as human beings. I mean, one of the things she did that was really interesting to me was that I think it was 2000 to 2006. She put together a calendar, a yearly calendar that was her unhoused clients and their dogs. And it was pictures of these people who regular citizens might step over and ignore as human beings. And it made them feel seen. And it reassured them that they were still humans, which is part what their pets do for them. I mean, those people don't have a lot of positive support. And yet, no matter who you are, if you treat an animal well, it will love you. It's
yeah.
your companion. It's always happy to see you.
There's some very dark parts of your book, which I'd like to touch on.
Okay.
One is that there is, and some of the people that have dogs that are on the streets or homeless use the dogs as trade, for drugs. Can you talk about that?
Well, because animals are valued as companions, and if you have an unfixed animal, it can easily bear puppies.
Mm-hmm.
And those puppies are very cute, and maybe somebody will give you $20 for it, $10 for it, and that's good for a hit of something.
Yeah.
Now, those people are not good people, and Downtown Dog Rescue does not help them. And in fact, in a recent effort, Skid Row recently, Lori had to withdraw some help from that area because she didn't think people were really looking for help. They were looking for money. On some level, those people are different only in degrees from people who breed dogs that there's really no market for.
That's,
you know?
Yes, that's exactly where thank you for pointing that out. I'm talking to Carol Mithers. Her book, this is a terrific read, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. I'm going to quote something, and I hope I've got this. It's not going to be word perfect, but I think I've got it right. You say that full animal shelters are not a pet problem or a people problem. It's a poverty problem. Carol, can you explain?
Sure. Those are actually Laurie's words.
Laurie, excuse me. Yes.
So give credit where it's due.
Yes.
So if you look at the shelter population, there are a very significant number of those animals in there were turned in by their owners. Others were found on the street. And if you look at where they came from, it is very likely that those are animals that began their lives with pet owners who did not have money. So why are those people losing their animals, giving up their animals? And there are a host of issues that are connected with their economic status that can result in that. Housing costs in Los Angeles and many urban centers are absolutely impossible and unaffordable. So if you're a family with a pet and you cannot find an apartment that will allow your pet and you find something you can afford, it's easy to say, I'd rather sleep on the street than get rid of my pet, but not if that's actually the situation you face. And so people sadly give up their animals. The cost of vet care right now is through the roof. It has gone up something like 60% in the last decade. Possibly, I would say almost certainly, because corporate consolidation and private equity have bought out a lot of pet hospitals and private veterinary practices. One company, Mars, the candy company, owns a huge chunk of the industry. And prices have gone up. And so if you're a low-wage worker and your animal gets an infection or breaks a leg or has some illness and you're quoted $1,000, $2,000, $5,000, what are your choices?
Yes.
Some people think that the shelter has a vet on site, which they do, but their point is not to take care of your wounded pet when it comes in. So they believe that the animal will get help there. Some people have ailing old pets and can't afford humane euthanasia, which is also expensive.
Yes.
The vet at the shelter will put down an ailing animal, but it's by itself. It's not, you can't be with your pet. So there are a host of issues that affect why someone in poverty cannot afford to be a pet owner, even when they want to be. So the question then becomes, why would you have a pet if you can't afford it? You shouldn't. It's a luxury. And my answer to that is that there are two things you have to look at, which is a moral answer and a practical answer. And morally, a lot of people who live in poverty lead really, really hard lives. And their kids lead really, really hard lives. And to say that you don't deserve the love of an animal if you're trying your best to care for it, and what you need is a little bit of help. In the end, what Lori did to help people hold on to their pets mostly didn't cost that much money. Their biggest expense, as always, is a vet issue. The practical answer is that if our shelters are full, if the animal, the humane movement is insisting we should all adopt, not shop, there are tens of millions of people in poverty or near the poverty level. So we're going to cut them out of the adoption. And that means who's going to adopt those animals? I would also argue that helping a pet owner with food or with subsidized vet care in the end is probably cheaper than confiscating the dog, holding it for who knows how long, watching it not get adopted, paying for workers at the shelter, feeding it, treating it, and then inevitably killing it. It's like it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
What we should be doing is preventing animals from going into the shelter, not worrying about them once they're there.
You know, I kept thinking about the title, Rethinking Rescue, and I'm curious to know whether you intended that to be a question or a statement.
I think more both, a little of both.
Both.
But, you know, Lori told me later on in our conversations that she wished she didn't have the word rescue in her group title.
Yes.
That it implied a kind of saviorism, and that that wasn't what she was about. That she said the dogs she took in, she thought of them most, and she still takes in some dogs and adopts them out, not that many, but that she thought of it more like recycling than rescuing. They were dogs that needed a new home. But the saviorism that has become a really major part of the whole rescue movement is maybe not the most productive thing we could do right now. That it implies that all of those animals that are taken in or that in their shelter were victimized by some terrible person, and that we, as usually more affluent people, are going to remedy the situation. And that's a kind of offensive attitude.
I'm glad you just touched on that, because it also leads to something that you point out in the book, and that is the rescue movement, I'm not going to say it's completely, but is certainly a lot, a main part of the rescue movement is affluent white women.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, if you look back historically, a lot of movements like suffragettes and anti-vivisectionists in the past were affluent white women. Temperance was affluent white.
White women.
So,
yeah.
Yes. So these movements don't pay anything. They demand a lot of time. They may demand resources. They demand energy. They demand political will. And if you are busy working three jobs or two jobs, you don't have energy for that. So you're getting a population that maybe has, because it is relatively privileged, has the time, energy, and money to do those things.
Yes.
Is there anything wrong with that? No.
No.
The only problem is if that movement, because of if its demographic, loses sight of the fact that other people's realities are very different from yours. You have to be, and I think that is what Lori did that is so hard, and that maybe other people did not do, which is that she could enter other realities and understand the pressures that people faced, the many obstacles that were in front of them. You know, we have such high standards now for dog care, and that's my childhood dog who lived outside in a house. I would be considered a terrible pet.
Yes,
by my parents.
Yes, yes.
But all those things cost money. Good dog food costs money. Vet care costs money. You know, having a house with a good fence so that your dog doesn't escape costs money. And we have to remember that other people simply don't have those things. It's not because they're bad people. It's because their lives are much harder.
Do you think it's true to say, Carol, that there's so much concern for animals, but little interest in helping pet owners and the conditions that they live in?
Yeah. Yes, because animals are, I say this in the book, animals are innocent and yeah. blameless, and we don't feel that way about people. We look at someone who's lying on the sidewalk and say, like, what did you do to mess up your life? And now the dog is paying the price. And we're simply, Americans especially, much more historically critical of people who are poor. It's their fault. I think that has started to change somewhat, but we blame people for their situations, and we never blame animals.
Yes.
Oh, God. And they're cute. They're cuter than us too.
Yes. Oh, that's for sure. I have a feeling talking to you that definitely was part of your plan, that you wanted people to really learn from what you're writing and what you've written. But I'm also thinking that there was something about I'm trying to search for the right word. I don't know that it was joyful so much as it may have been sad. I don't know. I'm going to throw it to you, Carol, to ask you what it was. Was it satisfying? I mean, what was it?
It was intellectually satisfying.
Yeah.
But it was also, in terms of the actual structuring, the writing was a freaking nightmare. Is what it
yes.
was.
Yeah.
Because I knew Laurie's story was straightforward, and yet it wasn't. It seemed to me if you wrote simply Laurie's story, you were just doing the story of another fabulous person, the savior. And that's not what she wants. And that didn't seem the whole story. And so as I talked to her endlessly, she was so nice to me and so patient, but I was doing a lot of just ordinary research. And I saw parallels that I had not seen when I first started, like the punitive aspect of rescue was mirrored some of the things that we due to parents in poverty. And I would see things as I read the paper that, you know, you if somebody isn't caring for their pet properly, you fine them. Well, they don't have the money. And so why would you give someone a fine when they already don't have money? And the result is that they may lose the pet. But we do that in some states to people who have driving violations. We take away their license and fine them, but they can't now get to work and pay the fine.
Yes.
And so there were all of these parallels, and yet it was really hard figuring out how to put it
yes.
together.
I think you say this in the book, that social justice and animal rescue are the same issue. And yes, I totally agree. Before we wrap, you've written a lot about women's issues, and let's just talk about you and your writing just for a moment, because I'd like my listeners to learn just a little
sure.
bit about Carol
sure.
Livers. Yeah.
Yes. Well, my last book, which I wrote with Liberian activist Lema Bowie, who won the Nobel Peace Prize like the week the book came out, was very exciting. I worked with her, helping her put her life into words. And that was an incredibly wonderful and satisfying experience, and difficult because I, like most Americans, knew nothing about the situation in Liberia and how their war had progressed and yeah. ended. And then I've written a million magazine articles. I was a working mid-level journalist for many years. I wrote for a lot of women's magazines about all of the usual subjects, ranging from what your bedroom says about you to date rape.
Yes. Yeah.
And my first book was the story of the rise and fall of a psychotherapy cult in Los Angeles. And that was also very satisfying, because it was about a terrible story that actually grew out of social conditions, which in a sense, rethinking rescue had certain similarities to that. And that's what really interests me, a story that comes out of other stuff that's going on. So what is it that bothers you? And, you know, that was, I thought of that when I was talking to Lori, is that she could have gone in any direction, but what bothers her was the suffering of people and animals on the street. And so that was what she addressed.
Carol Mithers has been my guest. The book is a terrific read. The title, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. Carol, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you for alerting my attention and many, many others to the plight of some of these animals and the people in poverty on the streets. It's, as I said, a terrific read. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Cool. That was a wonderful interview.
The link to Carol Mithers' important book is up at lifeelsewhere.co. Do go there. Next, we continue talking about pets. We're going to learn about the inner life of cats, the science and secrets of our mysterious feline companions with the author Thomas McNamee. And perhaps Thomas can explain why Billy, my cross-eyed Siamese cat, was a notorious underwear thief right after this.
We love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
The Inner Life of Cats. And the subtitle is The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Thomas McNamee is with us. Thomas, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's get right into it then. I'm one of those people that I sort of mumble and grumble about. I'm not really a cat person. I really don't like cats, even though I've owned a cat, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I sort of fall into that category of that I don't like cats very much, except cats always come to me. Always, always, always. And you mentioned this, and I want to find out about that.
Sure. I mean, this is, it's somewhat speculative, really, but the idea is that particularly with people cats don't know, looking a cat straight in the eye is taken as something of a challenge. It's considered somewhat aggressive. And so the person who doesn't like cats in a room, let's say, cat walks into the room, the non-cat person doesn't usually look at the cat. Cat takes that as the friendly gesture, looking down in a way, is taken as a modest hello. So the cat walks directly to that person.
Oh, I understand. Okay. Well, that explains a lot then, doesn't it? So let's get to the beginning of your book. And you talk about the evidence of something resembling domestication of the modern cat was thought until recently to have been identified in northern China. So when did we really find out about the domestication of cats, and how long have cats been domesticated?
Well, it partly depends on what you mean by domestication, but
yeah,
we know that they've been in company with humans for about 10,000 years. They, in other words, since the birth of agriculture, people began to store grain, and then cats and rats and mice came to steal it. And the North African wild cat began in North Africa and the Middle East, began to hang around hunting. And it turned out that that particular species had an ease around humans. And so they began to hang around the granaries hunting, and the humans thought that was a good deal. And presumably the young cats, kittens, were particularly friendly with humans. And so there began this 10,000 years of association. We don't know when they began to be really pets. And about 5,000 years ago, there's a temple painting in Egypt of a cat with a collar and a leash. Well, was that a sort of god cat? Because the Egyptians did come to have a couple of gods that had cat heads.
Yes.
Were those pets? We don't know, really. The real lap cat type, you know, your real house cat, may have developed only just a few hundred years ago. But we do know that the North African wildcat, which exists today in the deserts of North Africa, is the direct ancestor of our cats. that's a subspecies of this larger cat, the Felis sylvestris. There are many other subspecies around the globe, and only this one particular subspecies can be tamed.
Early in your book, you say, have you ever seen anybody try to pat a cat on the head like a dog? What a great question that is. And that's something which stopped me in my tracks when I thought about that.
Well, they don't like it. Most of what cats like in terms of the way you touch them is an imitation, an emulation, if you will, of how their mothers treated them as kittens. So mother cat licks the kitten's head to smooth its hair. And so your cat generally will like to have you stroke its head. Mother cat never goes bop, bop, bop on top of its head. I learned this a long time ago from the original horse whisperer. When I was living in Montana, we had this guy, Buck Brannaman, come and give us what he called clinics in horsemanship. And he would, people classically walk up to their horse and go bap, bap, bap on the horse's flank. And the horses hate it. You know, you've seen a horse shiver all over and to sort of shake flies off.
Yes.
And that's what they do when they don't like when somebody touches them. Then Buck would show us, look, you need to stroke your horse.
Right.
And then I realized when this cat walked into our lives in Montana that we also began to learn. And the cat will teach you what it likes and doesn't like. Some cats will actually, you know, if you pat them, they might sort of bite you.
Yes. In chapter two, the headline is Becoming a Cat. And then the first line is, and it's a very short sentence, a lot of cats have mental problems. Tom, you got to tell us about that.
Well, that chapter derives largely from a great, great study which was done by a woman named Elaine Karsh back in the 80s, and just before the beginning of the internet. And because of that timing, it's never become widely known. And it just remained sort of buried deep in the scientific literature. And I think it's the most important thing in my book and the most important thing that's been learned about cats in the modern era. Elaine found that kittens need to be handled by humans as early as the age of 2 weeks. And that the way their brains develop, there are these narrow windows of certain forms of mental development such that when they are handled, and by handling she means cuddled and talked to and held close to the body and so forth, they develop a confidence and a coolness and boldness and just a peacefulness that cats that don't get that treatment don't have.
Right, yes.
And so if kittens are raised that way, you get a remarkably stable and good cat. And unfortunately, you know, the gospel these days with veterinarians and cat raisers of all sorts is that, well, you know, you adopt a kitten at 7 weeks, or you just start to pay attention to kittens at 7 weeks, and the kitten's going to be fine. Well, it's not the case necessarily. I mean, many of them will, some won't. And it's this socialization process. And it, of course, if you start it early, you know, depending when you start it, it can still be fine. But a lot of times people start it too late, and a lot of cats then are sort of confused about their relationships with people, or they hear a car horn or a thunderstorm or something like that, and they're scared. And fear is a big factor in a lot, you know, we all know the term fraidy cat.
Yes, right? Yes.
So, you know, fear is a factor in cats' lives, and by starting a kitten very, very early, you end up with a cat that's very rarely afraid.
Then in chapter four, and you bring this issue up, which I think is so important, it's the question of domestication. All other domestic animals, you say, differ radically from their wild ancestors, but that's not the case in cats. Can you talk about that?
Sure. As I mentioned before, they're descended from the North African wild cat.
Yeah.
Most of our domestic animals are many thousands of years from their wild ancestors.
Yes.
Dogs, for example, at least 100,000 years, maybe much more than that, descended from wolves. Cats are very close to North African wild cats. I mean, you to this day, if you go to, if you were able to find a North African wildcat mother with kittens, and you could steal a kitten and take it home and raise it, and it would be pretty much a nice little cat to have. Whereas if you took the kittens from a European wildcat and tried to raise that kitten, it would tear up your furniture, it would be scratching you and yelling and trying to get out of the house all the time. It's a particularly adapted, particular subspecies of, of this cat that made it right for us. And yet, as domesticated as they are, they retain a lot of their wild ancestors' habits. So when the cat goes around your house rubbing its chin on the corner of the door,
yes,
and of course using the litter box and all these things, those are examples of the territoriality that the wild cat uses to mark off its territory.
Right.
You know, in this, those are, the cat is depositing pheromones, which are signposts to other cats. Other cats can smell them very easily. You can't. I mean, you go up to where the cat rubbed its chin on the doorpost, you can't smell it.
You can't smell it, right?
Other cats can tell, oh, well, that was the female cat. She's probably about 3 years old, and she's, she's coming into heat, maybe, and cats communicate with pheromones. And, of course, the litter box is, in many ways, the center of a cat's life, and that's why keeping a good litter box hygiene, very, very important in keeping cats happy. And that's what wild cats do. They have these middens, which are the center of their territory and also very important in communicating pheromonal messages. And a great many other things that are sort of confusing that cats do are holdovers from their ancestors' habits.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating book. The title, The Inner Life of Cats. Thomas McNamee is my guest. I want to talk about feral cats because you go into this in quite detail in your book. I'm a little concerned about feral cats because I happen to have an office and in the downstairs floor, there is a lady that feeds feral cats and I have a concern about that. Can you talk to us about feral cats?
It's a very complicated issue, Norman, and it's. If we had an hour, I could talk for the whole hour.
Yes,
but there are millions of feral cats in this country. We don't know how many, but possibly as many as 50 million, and the numbers are growing. And they do kill birds, and they kill a lot of birds. In some cases, the bird populations are not harmed by this because the birds just lay more eggs, and you know, birds die anyway. You know. Robins lay four eggs. So obviously, they're prepared for some birds to die.
Right.
But there are places where, on islands, for example, or in island-like habitats, where feral cats have driven species absolutely to extinction. In New Zealand and Australia, for example, they're the local birds evolved without four-legged mammalian predators. So feral cats just do terrible harm. In this country, people talk a lot about the harm that feral cats do, but they don't talk so much about the harm that feral cats suffer. The life of a feral cat,
yes,
in the city especially, is miserable. They have diseases. They get run over. Dogs kill them. They get in fights that kill them. A feral kitten has less than a 50% chance of making it to the age of 6 months.
Right.
There's this great humane program called Trap, Neuter, and Release, which is popularly used to try to reduce the populations of feral cats, and it has had some success at that. But the problem is that people still love to get a mama cat and have some kittens, and then they can't get rid of the kittens.
Exactly.
So they go out at night secretly when they can't give the kittens away, and they dump
them
in the park.
Yes.
And so the feral cat, and they, of course, those kittens haven't been neutered, have they?
Right.
And so the feral cat population grows and grows and
yes.
grows. And as hard as the people, the great cat lovers, try to reduce the populations, they grow anyway.
Yeah.
And then people like the person outside your window feeds cats. Well, what does that do? It keeps them going But there's no, I bet that person doesn't take them to the vet.
That's the problem. That's what I was going to get to, Tom, is that, and I know that this lady means well, and she feeds them copious amounts of food every day, and the population seems to increase every day, but there's also a population of really large raccoons. We my office overlooks a bit of a sort of a green area, a park area,
yeah.
And these raccoons come out of drains or somewhere, and these things are huge. They're just massive things, and they come along and they gobble up the cat food, and I think they sometimes gobble up the cats as well. Yeah,
they attack cats. In fact, my cat right now, Isabel, was attacked by raccoons in precisely that way.
Yes. She,
Isabel got into a big pile of cat food that was put out by one of these good-hearted but misled cat ladies who puts out giant piles of cat food.
Yes.
Isabel got into it, and she was attacked by a raccoon, almost bit her tail off.
Right. Yes. The book is called The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Well, a few years back now, I bought a cat, a Siamese cat, and we named this cat Billy. Well, Billy the Siamese cat was cross-eyed, as a lot of Siamese cats are. But this cat was, and I don't know, this is what I'm so excited to ask you about. Now, I don't know if this was unusual, but Billy talked a lot. He literally talked. He didn't meow so much as he made sort of almost like dog-like noises. Is that kind of typical for a Siamese cat?
It is, yeah. As you say, as are the crossed eyes. Purebred cats often have genetic problems. Now, talking, of course, is not really a problem.
Yes.
But crossed eyes are.
Yes.
The cat really can't see very well.
Right.
And unfortunately, as pure breeding goes on, and the Cat Fanciers Association, which is the one that establishes breed standards for cat shows and that kind of thing, as breeding goes on, it becomes inbreeding.
Uh-huh.
And as new breeds have been developed with more and more unique features, as these unique features are introduced into the breeding lines, genetic defects come about as well. And
yes.
They have hip dysplasia or also arthritis, and they develop arthritis, or they just have all sorts of other defects. And that's why, in general, if you want a new kitten, it's probably best to go to a shelter and get a good old mongrel.
Yes, yes.
Because they've got genetic diversity.
Yes.
And they've got hybrid vigor.
You talk about this the mental illness of cats and some of their, and I'm sure in writing your book and your experience with cats, that some of them do peculiar things. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but Billy, the cross-eyed Siamese cat, he used to do this. He would go to the drawer where I kept my underwear, and he would manage to open it, and he would take a pair of underwear out of the drawer, and then he would drag it across the floor to the kitchen where his food was set out for him in a food bowl. And he wouldn't eat his food until the underwear was draped across the food bowl. And then he would... Now, I know it's bizarre. It's bizarre, isn't it? But is it that bizarre?
No, actually, I think I know what he was doing. Wild cats, after they've made a kill and they've eaten, will hide the food to keep it away from other animals.
Yes.
So they cache it, in other words, for to protect it. Mountain lions always do this. You know, they'll kill a deer, and a deer is more than a mountain lion can eat in a single meal, and so they'll drag the deer off into the brush, and they'll use those big paws to scratch and scratch and scratch and pull duff and leaves and stuff to cover the deer in the hope that other mountain lions or other carrion feeders won't get at it. So your Siamese, I guess, was trying to hide his or her.
It was a he. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. Trying to hide his food, but going for your underwear. That That's pretty much a stretch of the ancestral behavior.
I know, yes. I mean, I kind of sort of figured it might be something like that. And I just thought maybe the underwear was because it was just an easy thing to drag across the floor. It was small enough or so he could get it into his mouth. But the fact was he was very clever. And cats are really clever at opening things, aren't they?
They are. Maybe it had a little residual smell of you. It may have been a bit of an act of devotion.
Yes, that could be it. Which is sort of... It goes into the area of being very, very weird. Now, you touched...
It does go into this category of weird.
That's you touched on something about the Siamese cat, but it's also with all cats. I want to talk about their eyes and their eyesight. They can see things that we can't see in the dark, but they can't see close up, you say. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, their eyes are, as you say, they can see in the dark. Their eyes are as big as ours.
Yes.
A little, 10, 12-pound cat has eyes as big as ours, and they have this particular mirror-like retina. We call it the tapetum lucidum. I have all this technical stuff in there that you don't necessarily need to know, but if there's going to be a quiz, that reflects the light back and magnifies, and intensifies the light. And that's why if you shine a flashlight or something in a cat's eyes at night, you see that bright gold reflection. And so, yes, they can see extremely well at night, and there's a sacrifice made for that, which is the sacrifice of vision up close. And so, if you give your cat a little treat on the floor, they sort of have to sniff around to find it because they can't actually see it very well. But they're very well adapted to seeing motion. For example, they perceive motion as a series of little stills, like a movie.
Right.
And that's how they can so precisely, except very fast, much faster, many more frames per second than a movie. And so that's how they can snatch a hummingbird zooming past in the air. They just grab it like a shortstop, grabbing a line drive.
Now, talk to me about the pupils, because that's something I think fascinates us all, is the shape of their pupils.
Right. Of course, they're not round like ours. Well, they're round when they're wide open, as they are in the dark, and then, of course, they shut down to the narrow slit in bright sunlight, so they have a wide, wide range of ability to adjust to the light.
Right. Yes, but do they see things with? Because I think it's always what we when we're looking at a cat, like the cat on the cover of your book. I'm sort of wondering, are they just seeing sort of a very narrow vision like that, or it's not? It's just that's the way their pupil is made.
Yeah, that's just how it's made.
They're just
adjusting for pure accuracy of perception.
Yes,
of light.
So I've got to ask you about this, and you mentioned it in your book. Licenses. Dog have to have licenses. Why not cats?
Yeah. Why not? Because then, for example, when people dump their cats, I think everybody who has a cat should have an embedded a barcode reader in the back of just behind the head in the neck. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
And then when your cat gets lost, they pick it. Whoever picks it up, it maybe goes to the SPCA or to the local, pet agency. They all have these readers now, and it'll have your name and address and phone number, and then you can they'll get in touch with you and take your cat back. You won't have to have lost your cat.
And
this could be a form of licensing.
Yes.
And that way, people who dump their cats will damn well get them back.
Right. Yes. Which leads nicely into a story that you tell us about a cat named Holly. Can you talk about a cat named Holly?
Yes. When it was found, it was lost in South Florida, and made her way, and her people couldn't find her. They looked and looked and looked, couldn't find her, and they went back. I don't remember the cities involved. I think maybe it was in Miami, and then they went back to their home in northern Florida, quite a long, long way.
Yeah,
and eventually, Holly just turned up. And had found her way through, across expressways and through swamps and backyards, a million backyards, and somehow had found her way back to them.
Now, is that because she used, was that smell? How was that possible?
Oh, she had a chip. She had the
oh, she had a chip. Yeah,
that's
yeah. Right.
And she turned up in a backyard near their house, hadn't quite found them, But she was starving to death. She was just about falling down, and the person who found her took her to the vet, and the vet, fed the cat and for a little while and brought her back to, you know, more or less life, and then took her to the nearest place, I guess, municipal authorities,
right,
somewhere where they had the right kind of reader, and they, sure enough, and there were her people's name and address, and Holly got taken home.
Fascinating story. The whole book is fascinating. I need to ask you, in doing the research for the book and in putting the book together, because you've got such a lot of detail in here, and as I said earlier on, it really is very readable. Even if you're not really predisposed to cats, The Inner Life of Cats is just a good read. But Tom, when you were putting the book together and as you were collating it and get into the final stages of it, was there something that sort of made you stop in your tracks, that you discovered about cats that you hadn't known beforehand?
Well, first of all, there was that Elaine Karsh study that I alluded to about the early nourishing of cats, nurturing of cats, I mean to say. And I think also that I came to appreciate much more that with greater the complexity of cats' ability to communicate with us. There was a study done in 1944, again, an early study that had been largely lost by a woman named Mildred Mulk, who studied her three cats at home for years, listening to the subtle differences of their vocalizations and coordinating those with the behavior that followed them, or in many cases, her behavior that followed the things that her cats said.
Yes.
So her cats were trying to say certain things to her, and she figured out what those things were, and it turned out they had a great deal to say. And she also figured out that all cats can have a great deal to say, but you have to develop it.
Yes.
All these things develop as dialogues between the person and the cat, where the cat has a certain kind of a meow, and you imitate it, you say it back to the cat, and eventually you figure out what the cat's trying to say.
Right.
And the funny thing about this is that as complex and expressive as the language may turn out to be, it might not be the same as the language that develops between your neighbor and her cat.
Right.
Because, you know, you work it out with
yes.
your own cat.
Yes, so yes.
It's like, you know, different dialects of the same language.
Yeah, which again leads me back to my cat, Billy the cat, the cross-eyed Siamese cat, who talked all the time. He didn't meow so much as he literally made sort of little yelps and barks. I mean, it was the most bizarre thing. And he didn't stop, and he wouldn't shut up. He was very noisy.
Siamese are famous for that.
Yes,
my cat, Isabel, is part Bengal, and she doesn't meow much either. But she goes, that's my name. That's Tom in Bengal.
Right.
So when she greets me in the morning, she says, and then there's, which is feed me, and so on. And she has lots of noises that are not regular cat noises at all. She also can meow, but she also has a whole string of Bengal sounds.
Have we discovered, or do we know, and from what you found out in writing your book, do cats like us? Do they like humans?
Absolutely, they do. This is somewhat speculative, but I believe that, first of all, if we go back to the North African wildcat, it was clear that even in their completely wild state, they had a tolerance for being close to humans. And I believe that over time, that tolerance developed into a fondness, and that there was a latent capacity already there in their genes for human companionship, and that over time, that gene, the genetic disposition for companionship, became a disposition for love. And there's no question that when we love our cat will love us back.
Ah, yes.
And
yes.
You can find books that say, no, they don't love us, it's just a dependency or something like that. But of course, you can take apart human love in the same way. You can deconstruct human love as a mere transaction.
Yes.
If you want to, you know, if you want to be cynical about it, it's just a deal.
Yes.
It's a transaction. But if you take any traditional definition of love, I think cats fit it.
And you talk about love in your book, of course. Thomas McNamee has been our guest. Thomas, it's been a fabulous conversation. Really enjoyed talking with you.
I have too.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.